Following how Iran would react to Israel's April Fool's rocket attack against the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Now that we know, what will Israel do next? There's amazing developments in this story, too numerous and changing too rapidly to keep up with in a brief introduction like this, but suffice to say, we're entering an age of trepidity where each next step could spell. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has too been a professor of geology and as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, released biography Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. His latest article at Dances with Bears is Loose Lips Don't Sink Ships or Israel. John Helmer and Sparking the Electric War in the Second Half. But first, Stuart Parker, Canadian volunteer in exile. Welcome to the program, Stuart.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, Stuart, you're ensconced happily now in Dar es Salaam. Is it fair to say, Stuart, the journey from here to there began for you with John Horgan's selection call 2020?
No, I think that I think those forces were gathering earlier. I think that this in 2015, I think that if you look at the sociological data, these major shifts in the culture of the left, in tolerance for dissent, questions of mental health, the need for people to dissemble about their political opinions, the need to adhere to new kinds of orthodoxy, those things all really began crystallizing in 2015 with the lead up to the British and American vote, Brexit in the UK, and of course the Trump presidential year in the United States. I think that a lot of this stuff became inevitable then. I think 2020 was the year things shook out for me. I was on a track, Manichaean conflict with the creature that is shambling around in the flayed skin today.
So let's talk. When I became aware of your political progress, let's say, with the eco-socialists here to the 2020 election in British Columbia, the eco-socialists were making some noise and eco-socialism was gaining some traction on the national stage as well. And it seemed like it might be the center of the left at the time, at least amongst optimists. And I think I had optimism myself at that time. You were leader of the then nascent British Columbia Socialist Party. Do you want to tell us what the party was then and what it was for you?
The Eco-Socialist Party was a Hail Mary project, and it was a very strange one. I was paid by an eccentric millionaire to create a socialist party for him. So how was that plan going to go wrong? I mean, the punchline kind of writes itself. Certainly, there was sincere, genuine shock and disillusionment when the Horgan government voted through $6 billion in subsidies for liquefied program, gave $1 billion to Royal Dutch Shell and used the RCMP as the brute squad for a fossil fuel project that pushed a pipeline for fracked natural gas through the territory of the Wet'suwet'en people, contrary to the wishes of the Wet'suwet'en hereditary government. So I think there was a lot of outrage. But I think we were always on a very flimsy footing. I left the NDP over that, certainly. I realized there was, and the thing was, at the point the government had a one-vote majority in the legislature. Anyone, NDP or Green MLA, could have brought that government down. And the fact that there was not a single one of those people with courage or principle to do that, I thought, right, well, these parties are done. Now, at that point, I was still organizing with Jeff Berner, who I'd been organizing with on and off, really, since we were five. And Jeff had come into some money due to the death of his parents, so he could afford to employ me at a small scale and my longtime organizing partner, Alana, to put together this eco-socialist party. But obviously, if the original power dynamic is paying you to create a socialist party for him, you can see where that's going to go. The party was always weak in terms of its connection to grassroots movements because themselves had become sick. over the 5 to 10 years previous, our social movements had become afflicted with very, very serious problems. So the thing was that the Eco-Socialist Party looked great on paper, and to people who were historic members of the political course, these are the policies we used to believe in, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, even those policies couldn't be held in place. Now, and I don't want to just emphasize, of course, my cancellation over my disbelief in gender wang. I think an equally telling element of what happened to the eco-socialists was I had run on a radical police reform platform for Surrey City Council in 2018. We put forward pages and pages of policies for reestablishing civilian control of the police, reestablishing new forms of community safety, changing our urban planning, making cities safe spaces for women, making suburbs safe spaces. And so the eco-socialists started out with a half dozen pages of policies for radical police reform. And one of the first things that happened when my, and let's be clear, 3-week leadership of the party ended. I was only ever the leader for 3 weeks. The first thing they did was remove all 6 of those pages and replace them with the hashtag defunds.
When you talk about the situation in the province at that time, the political disaffection broadly in not only the NDP, which isn't a surprise to people for a long time, but also with the Green Party of British Columbia as well. That, as you mentioned, the balance of power was so that I think they had 2 seats at the time, if I'm remembering right.
They had 3
right.
seats. 3. Only one of the 3 Green MLAs was needed to bring the government down.
And they say,
gas subsidies. No, they didn't, because they voted against them in a symbolic vote in 2018. And 6 months later, when it came time to pass those subsidies in the budget again, they all...
That's exactly what I mean. The decision was so fraught and the balance was so tenuous politically here in the province. The prospect of another party like the eco-socialists coming along and getting even 1 seat or 2 seats, it could make a massive difference, not only to the Green Party of British Columbia's fortunes, but maybe finding some actors in the legislature here that would actually topple governments over these projects that that the Green Party failed to move on, that they let down a huge number of NDP voters, for example, who were against these pipelines and still are, but were not finding any satisfaction.
You know what the Greens did obtain concessions from the NDP. The Weaver did obtain concessions, and those concessions were things like bringing in Uber. They were things like slowing the minimum wage. It's not merely that the Green Party failed to improve things. It's they actually used their negotiating power to increase carbon emissions.
So here we are, for those people that aren't aware of British Columbia politics and that, we're at this position. You're in this nascent party, this eco-socialist party, mm-hmm. in a very turbulent political atmosphere. And then out of the government decides to drop the writ fully 2.5 years before it's required to, and call a snap election as we're in the very early stages of the COVID shutdowns, where people really don't know what's going on even then in summer of 2020. Tell me what you guys thought when the writ came down so unexpectedly.
Well, it was not surprising. I mean, it was a disgusting and undignified display. The Horgan government had been telling people that it was unsafe to go out, that you had to not gather unless it was vitally necessary. Now, of course, they were complete hypocrites on that front, in that they actually smashed the quarantines that were instituted by Indigenous reserves and forced tourists onto those reserves. They kept industrial sites like Site C working with their 1,000-person mess hall. But never mind that. Not only did the government basically say, oh, no, now that it's convenient for us to have an election, everything we about public gathering and unnecessary congregating is out the window. They were out the window to benefit the NDP. And then the Green Party stated that by agreement, which they signed, saying they wouldn't call an election in 2020, back in 2017. And the Green Party begged them to not call the election and said, look, we will vote for whatever you want. This is great. Green Party has somehow not already supplicated sufficiently. So we went into this election and I had a tremendous sense of dread because I knew I had been effective in presenting the eco-socialists as a party that was ready for prime time. And while we had recruited some very solid candidates and had some really great organizers, I knew that what I was working with was a paper tiger, that we might have all kinds of people, but we had not built the kinds of social movement connections we needed in order to have a deep connection.
But was that necessary? But given the situation at the time, I mean, how necessary are those things? All you needed was maybe one seat, maybe two seats. It was, you know, enough to begin. I mean, these are very early days after all. You don't have to come in as a completed project or anything.
Oh, yes. But there have actually been very few political parties that have ever won any seats in the BC legislature. Yeah. I mean, let's be clear. There have been less than 10 in the past 150 years. But my point is that it's not just about getting people elected. My point is that because of the cultural changes our society and social movements had undergone, there wasn't really a way that we could deliver legislators who we could know would have a backbone. Mm-hmm. The thing that gives a backbone is not just that person's character. It is their connection to social movements that hold them to account. The NDP's severing of social movements is the primary force that makes their MLAs cowards, not the individual character flaws of the MLAs. So the problem was, I knew and personally trust to hold the line in the legislature under pressure, but there was no real way to know whether we would just deliver another set of Adam Olsons and Sonia First.
Was it, don't know, those,
yeah,
already,
those are the two members of the legislature for the Green Party, yes, in British Columbia right now. So I guess what I want to say is, I mean, this was a Hail Mary. This was my last real intervention on the left in Canadian politics. But I just wanted to say, you know, I had an experience just the year before. People don't have a sole memory of Operation Solidarity, but one of the biggest general strikes in Canadian history took place in British Columbia in 1982. And the guy who was supposed to be leading the strike was the head of the BC. He had a breakdown. And Jack Munro, the head of the International Woodworkers of America, took control of the strike, shut it down, and conceded. And most people like my generation grew up with this story of the betrayal of Jack Munro and how Jack Munro had shut us down and how he'd sold us out. And then I finally met Art Kuby when, you know, Kuby was 90 years old or whatever. And he said, no, I had a breakdown and Munro took control because I knew the whole strike was going to collapse within a week. That people actually weren't willing to stay off the job. I had no plan, and Munro had a plan. And I feel a little bit like Art Kuby. Like, I could absolutely mourn and say I was leading this political movement that was highly principled, that could have turned things around. But I think that if we actually want to happen to the left, the wrong we've gone, and the half decade of disaster that has ensued since, we have to be honest with ourselves. The problem really went, and why it was so easy to remove me from the leadership of the party. It was so easy to remove my friends. It was so easy to shut the party down that we had built on sand.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Stuart Parker. Stuart describes himself as a Canadian political exile. He's living now in Dar es Salaam, the House of Peace. He left Canada last year after suffering what he describes as a three-year campaign of neo-McCarthyite blacklisting. We were talking a little bit about his long in this province, east in Ontario as well, and the Eco-Socialist Party itself. Now, you mentioned, Stuart, the gender wang. Can you explain? I know that you, on your website, you say if you don't know what gender wang is, you're on the wrong website page. What do you mean by it?
Well, it's a term that Jonathan Kay coined. I used to refer to this thing as the gender orthodoxy. And I don't just see it as being about gender. It's a whole system of belief. Large portions of the West, particularly left-identified progressives, have embraced a quasi-religious ideology. They believe that We all have pre-existent, immaterial, undetectable souls that possess a gender and a race. And with increasing frequency, these pre-existent souls are being born in the wrong bodies. And radical medical interventions have to be taken place in order to deal with the body-soul asymmetry. This is a fairly common sort of belief you get in American space religions like Mormonism, Scientology, the Nation of Islam. Unfortunately, because Canadians are very bad at detecting religions, they're essentially interacting with this thing as though it's a pseudoscience. But Wang is not. I mean, problems to have with it in terms of the safety of women who are incarcerated, the fairness of sports for women, the physical safety and health of troubled children who are given life-altering medical procedures, sterile and inesmic. But my main concern with gender weighing is not that. It's that, like a fanatical religious movement, it does not permit itself to be questioned, raises core objections. The term is canceled now. But, you know, we've been around long before the present. The term cancel culture is really a euphemism for what this really is. It's McCarthyism. And there was a time when the anti-communist movement of the United States didn't just control the political right, it controlled the political left as well. And unions purged members who either were communists or did the thing that I did, which was to stand up and say, this person isn't a communist. Or in my case, what I said was, Judy Graves is not a bigot. Judy Graves is a feminist. She has a long history of working with trans-identified people. Her oldest friend is one. She provided him with all of his palliative care during the last year of his life. And so when people were attempting to cancel more organizations, my voice. And it was not so much that I agreed with Judy Graves, I did privately, but I simply said to Judy, that people should not be unpersoned, pushed out of civic associations, pushed out of political parties, pushed out of their jobs, simply orthodoxy that has captured the elite. The same things happened to suspected communists in the 50s. And in fact, one of the things I did my last year in Vancouver was I interviewed Don Todd, the socialist philosopher from Simon Fraser University, who had been blacklisted during the 90s Red Scare over his membership in the California Communist Party in 1951. So what I want to emphasize here is that, yes, the identitarians are... But these were the tactics of Erich Honecker's dictatorship in East Germany. They were called Zersetzung then, and they were used by the anti-communists in 1950s America, and they were called McCarthyism then.
What I heard about this with you, Stuart, was, of course, the famous J.K. Rowling connection. Do you want to talk about what happened now when you're still sitting at the atop the eco-socialists? There's an election looming. And now this breaks out.
So I defended Judy Graves. That was the context in which I mentioned J.K. Rowling. Mm-hmm. I wasn't actually defending J.K. Rowling. I was defending Judy Graves, and I was saying that things had been misrepresented. And that was sufficient to label me hell-bent on the murder of every trans-identified person in the world, of course. And for being transphobic, I was attacked for being transphobic. I had only ever intended to be the interim leader of the party. I had been trying to recruit Harold Steeves to lead the party. So I resigned, hoping that the party would be able to carry on. But instead, once they smelled blood in the water, Nicholas Spur, a Green Party candidate, himself in charge of determining whether the eco-socialists were transphobic or not. So naturally, a candidate for an opposing party is going to just elaborate this process indefinitely until the party ran no candidates. and shut itself down because, of course, the individuals in the party were all threatened with these smears that if they went forward and round, they would be labeled as transphobic. And like me, they would end up losing their jobs. They would end up losing their relationships. They would end up losing their savings and their homes. So, I mean, the point is you can't, once you start conceding this, the process elaborates indefinitely because it's so convenient to be able to shut down people and organizations this way. When I went to the Deep Green Resistance Conference in 2023, everyone there had led an organization that the genderists had sought to shut down, not even because of things they'd said, but because it had been exposed that one person had a personal friendship with someone who was gender critical.
That was
enough to have their organization assailed and defunded. So,
do you know anybody that has ever been is kind of where we're going.
How they test. Will you denounce your friend?
With the eco-socialist, their spokesperson, I'm looking at a Victor's article. Deanna Dershowitzky, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but she says, quote, "While it's terrible that this situation has caused harm to the trans community," the situation being you, Stuart, "I think the silver lining is that this is the first election ever where trans issues have been front and center in the party." Now, as you describe, you were accused unfairly, you say, and in a typical way of this McCarthyite practice, the election right at a time when it could maybe do something and certainly was its best opportunity. And now the silver lining of affecting a minuscule minority of the population is front and center for the party enough to bring a party down.
Yeah, let's be clear. It's not a minuscule portion of the population. If you go into a grade 6 or grade 7 classroom in East Vancouver or downtown Victoria, 50% of the girls in that, and the government will be preparing to prescribe them chemical lobotomization drugs to prevent them going into puberty. So let's be clear. It's affecting more and more people. But yes, at the time, the argument is, oh, this is a tiny minority.
What are you saying? Wait a second. Are you saying half of a typical
grade 6 or 7 class? Half of the girls.
The girls are identifying as male and wanting to transition.
If you were a girl growing up in this porn culture, wouldn't you?
No, I don't think I would.
Well, I'd suggest you walk into some upper division elementary school classes. Because that's what happens when you relentlessly propagandize kids with the middle head fallacy.
Oh, okay. Now, I've just got a time warning.
No, I understand. There's a time warning.
The Zoom is going to unzoom us pretty soon, and I didn't get
anything through. So let's just wrap up on a few points then.
Hit the big ones.
Yeah. So anyway, if folks want to read more about this, I'm working on a memoir out here in Tanzania, and if you want to watch this as they come off the press, please find me on Patreon. But if you want to read the essays that were generated during the meltdown of the Eco-Socialist Party, during my cancellation, that try to capture some of these moments, I just released a 4-volume edited collection. It's available on Amazon. And 2008, which is when I began writing about my concerns that there was a new authoritarian left emerging. My first essay on that subject was on rabble.ca back in 2008, because there's some really disturbing polling numbers during Stephen Harper's prorogation crisis. So I think it's useful. It's certainly, if you were in Southwestern in the fall of 2020, this all seemed to have exploded. But if we're going to get a handle on that explosion, we have to understand how long the kindling had been building up, how much pent-up energy suddenly was released during my cancellation and the destruction of the party.
Well, it's collected essays, 2008 to 24. The author is Stuart Parker, Stuart Parker. You can find it, as Stuart says, at Amazon. And that is Dimension Fold Publishing, I believe. And what's your website?
Out of Prince George, our tiny little Prince George's tiny yet persistent publishing firm of Ken Goutsword.
And your website?
Stuartparker.ca and losaltos.ca is the institute I run. And if you'd like to work with some of the refugees from the board of the Eco-Socialist Party, you'll find many of them serve on the board of directors on reading groups. We have meetups. We do stuff in southwestern BC and around the world online.
Oh, Stuart, I'm sorry that we ran out of time. There was more to talk about in your new life, a Canadian abroad in Africa, in Tanzania there, but we'll have to save that for the next time. Thanks a lot for coming on, though, eh?
Yeah, thank you, and I do hope...
Me too, and I want everyone else to stay tuned. After the break, John Helmer's going to be here. Lord Cameron, the British foreign minister, has said he agrees that Israel should strike back. It retaliated for the embassy bombing that Israel was responsible for. Tit for tat. It looks like we're running into more trouble. He's going to be here to talk about the coming electric one, Stuart.
All right, thanks.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle has taken you for walks in the park, or that he's a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, the last 2 weeks, the world has been on tenterhooks, not knowing how Iran would react to Israel's April Fool's rocket attacks against the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Well, now that we know, what will Israel do next? There's amazing developments in this story, too numerous and chained in a brief introduction like this, but suffice to say, we're entering an age of trepidity where each step could spell a disastrous fall. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russians and Were Caught, and his latest released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. His latest article at Dances with Bears is Loose Lips. Welcome back to the program, John.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, you know, it's always my pleasure. But so, John, as of writing and as of talking right now, it's 3 p.m. time on April 17th. As of this moment, Israel has promised retaliation for the Iranian retaliation to its errant Fool's Day's aggression. The British Lord Cameron has said that's all fine and hunky-dory with him, is the latest I've seen. We've saw over the weekend a hint at what Iran is capable. In your article, as mentioned, as well as warning that we ain't seen nothing yet, you outline a possibility, John, that the next phase strategy that may parallel what we've talked about in the past regarding the Russia-Ukraine conflict, namely an electric war. Do you want to carry it from there?
Thank you, Chris. Yes, well, let's be very clear.